It's Saturday, May 29th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News, in the second half, your questions and comments about technology. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Theme song today is from Dave Patera. Thank you very much for that. If you'd like to participate by making a theme song for us, please do so and send it information to us at the Geek Speak website. You can send information, ask questions, whatever you'd like. Geek Speak is a Creative Commons endeavor, which means that you can do anything you'd like with this. You can share it and such, as long as you don't make money without asking us first. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Geek Speak. And in the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie. Good morning. Oh, let me, you know, what I'll do is I'll turn mics on before I introduce you. Lindsay, hi.
Good morning.
You're on five, aren't you? We're like in a mix today.
I think I'm on four. There we go.
You're on five.
There she is.
Missing gear in the air room is always fun. Alex Salias is definitely on line three.
Good morning, Lyle.
Good morning. And, of course, Al Luckow. Good morning.
Hello, everybody.
We're going to be doing Geek News in just a minute. Al's going to tell us about an expensive mistake by Microsoft. But first, let's ask Lindsay a little bit about genetic testing.
So last week, it looks like a few big companies, namely Pathway Genomics, was releasing home genetic testing to places like Walgreens, where you can just go pay $30 and do a saliva swab and send it away, and it'll tell you what you're susceptible for, including different types of cancers. Yeah, there's a lot of people concerned about the effectiveness and how the results are going to be interpreted by the people taking the test.
So the idea is that you never actually give the results to anybody else.
Right. You send it away. You do send it away to the lab.
Okay.
And then they will also put it online so you can access your results online. And they
so
will send
why
it back
is it a home
you.
Test? Just because you get the swab yourself
right.
and you send it in. Okay, so
exactly.
Mail-ordered genetic testing.
Right. You can just go to the drugstore, pay $30, and do it that way. I'm sure there's other places where you can send away.
That's kind of neat. I mean, isn't it it's the perfect thing for hypochondria.
Exactly. Yeah. But it could encourage people to do things. They're saying, you know, there's two sides of it. It could encourage people to, like, stop smoking or go and get a pre-screening cancer test or something like that if they get certain results. But they're also saying that people might panic and freak out and have stress, which would be difficult for their immune system and maybe make them more susceptible.
I might die of these three things.
Exactly.
Right. Like you will now.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting. It's not really related, but there's a company called 23andMe. I don't know if you've heard about that. But
isn't that Google's the wife of one of the Google guys?
Exactly. And it's along the same lines. I don't know if they're releasing anything. I haven't really checked on their website lately. But it's a lot of interesting stuff where you can go and pick and choose what types of genetic testing you want to do. I think they even do dating testing where you can see if you're chemically compatible with somebody and things like that. I guess that's the idea, but they're not public help or anything.
All right. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. In just a minute, we're going to talk about a data center in Silicon Valley, that Alex's stories. But first, what is going on with Microsoft? What mistake did Microsoft make, Al?
Well, we have to turn back the hands of time a little bit. Back to, say, 1996 or 1997, at a time when Apple wasn't really doing that well.
Was really recently.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a long time ago to some people. Mm-hmm. Like, if Ben were here, we'd make fun of how young he was then.
Sure.
So, in 1997, Apple wasn't doing fabulous. Steve Jobs had come back to the company in 1996. They hadn't launched the iMac yet. That happened in 1998. So, you know, Jobs comes back. Apple's not doing that great. Everybody's just, you know, they're never going to get anywhere and all this kind of stuff. Jobs came back, big deal. They needed money. So Steve Jobs went to Microsoft and he asked for some money. you know, you want to invest in us, if you want to do that, we'll do a deal with you. We'll let you use some of the patents and do some cross-licensing agreements that, you know, that we have and a lot of our software you can use. And in turn, we would like some investment in our company as well as an agreement to continue your versions of Office.
Right.
And you know, so for the Mac. And they also wanted, at that time, Microsoft wanted Apple to install Internet Explorer as the default browser, which, of course, we know was the... ended up being like a big antitrust thing. But, yeah. They were saying, well, make Internet Explorer your default browser, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so Apple agreed to a bunch of these little things because, you know, they're a struggling
company. They needed
money.
They needed, like, a boost, right?
Yeah. So, you know, Apple comes out with the iMac. Pretty good, you know, pretty successful. This was the candy-colored ones,
sure.
Different colors. I have one in my house right now. Good buy right now, though, if you can pick one of those up. They're
great,
like 50
for kid
bucks.
Games and
oh,
stuff,
yeah.
Too.
Go to the Goodwill and get some kid games anyway. So, you know, they had this thing, and I think Microsoft invested $150 million into the company, which was 150,000 shares of Series A preferred stock.
Mm-hmm. That's so, not that much money they put in.
They put kind of a lot, you know. Yeah. Anyhow, they had decided that at some certain point that, you know, it's just Apple's still faltering. It's going nowhere.
Right.
Let's just sell all this stock. After the agreement was over.
And they probably
know,
made some money, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They made money, certainly, because it was certainly better after Jobs had returned. So they sold all of their stock, and I can't say exactly when.
Right.
They did it at a healthy profit. But what if they hadn't decided to sell that stock? How much would that stock be worth today?
Because Apple stock's kind of high right now, right?
Apple stock's kind of high right now, yeah. If they had held on to the stock instead of just selling all of it, which is what they did, if they had held on to it, they would have made an additional $4.95 billion.
If they sold it now, for example.
Yeah. It's a 3,200% return on investment.
And, okay, so speaking of that, last week, Apple's market cap surpassed Microsoft's, right?
Right.
So Apple's actually a bigger company than Microsoft now.
Actually, Apple is considered the world's most valuable technology company. Of course, Steve Ballmer, who's the current CEO of Microsoft, also one of the... Is he co-founder? Or?
No.
No? Well, he was with Gates when they started it. He recently downplayed the significance of the market cap course, which you'll always hear Ballmer. He's the one that said, the iPhone, that's just a toy! You know, he's a character.
Yeah. I believe he's also the one who had the monkey dance on stage, right?
I don't know if you...
Steve Ballmer, monkey dance, Google it.
Well, no. Anyhow, it was a big mistake by Microsoft.
To sell it.
And now they're at this point where Apple has actually surpassed their value. So I just thought it was kind of an interesting little twist.
If you could summarize one thing that Apple does right, the reason why it's so successful, what would it be?
I think that they, rather than focus on the technology, they focus more on the people and create
usability.
Things people want.
Yeah.
Yep.
I would phrase it in one word as design.
Design. Yeah.
Well, they've always been. That's the thing they've always been known for.
And they separate the engineering and the design, and they say these are two separate things, whereas a lot of companies, they will have their engineers do the design.
Yeah.
you know, and it's like, it shows.
Yeah. You know, the whole thing about the stock is I feel that pain because I bought stock, I mean, granted, not quite in the 90s, mm-hmm. but I bought some back in 2003, made a little profit. I think mm-hmm. I sold it for about 25% profit. And then they announced that we're going to be this big company, and they just kept going and going. And then they split, and they kept going and mm-hmm. going. I think that $500 would have been worth like $20,000 now.
You know, I had a friend who was at Cisco during the day, you know, when they were like shooting up. And he was... he had gotten Cisco stock, and he was basically, you know, he became a millionaire because of that. He was an engineer mm-hmm. guy or something. But at one point, you know, he was living in a house with a bunch of people, and they weren't, you know, they weren't making a lot of money at that point, and they needed to buy a couch. So he sold some of his stock to buy a couch, just a small amount. But then after that, it was like a year after that, the Cisco stock just was shooting up. Everything was, and they ended up calling it their $60,000 couch because that's what it ended up being worth.
I was working for a tech company in the .com phase, and it went out of business, and I was a contractor, and I think they owed me $40,000 when it went under. Mm. And I was already struggling when it went under. And so... But when they went under, I had a chair, an office chair that they had actually loaned me. Mm-hmm. It went to me somehow, and it was like a loan. So it was my $40,000 office chair. Excellent. And it's still floating around right now. My son used it in his room. Uh-huh. And recently there was a discussion of if we need to get rid of that chair. I'm like, oh, that's worth $40,000.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's all relative.
Yes, it is. Gosh, I wish I made that kind of money now. Oh, anyway. But my life is so full. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, I'm not doing a back update. I should do a back update. My back's still broken. Okay, moving on. in just this minute, Lindsay is going to tell us about the first computer virus that's kind of made the jump. It's infected a human. We'll find out what that is about in just a second. But first, what's up with the data center in Silicon Valley?
All right, well, speaking of growth in technology industry, mm-hmm. It seems we've got some data center build-outs have been occurring in Silicon Valley. There's been a bit of a lull with the economy downturn. Mm-hmm. And... there really wasn't a whole lot of need for new data centers. And I guess lately it's been booming quite a bit to the point where this last spring, a company called Digital Realty Trust has been buying up. They just bought a couple of new data centers that they're going to be building out. They just bought one 2 weeks prior.
Really?
They're buying up buildings to build out into a data center. And they're talking like now, I think between these three, it's around it'll probably end up being about 70,000 square feet for data center space, where the buildings themselves arrive at 120,000 square feet.
It's so funny because after speaking of the boom, after that point, there was this plethora of data centers, and they were actually going on. Like, there's one in Santa Cruz that just kind of fell apart, and they ripped it out and put in a shopping center or something else in there. And I thought I've always thought that there's too many data centers. That's like, but because that's not the case.
Well, the problem then was there was a lot of money, people wanting to throw money into data centers. So they were building them out and building them out and then thinking, well, the business would be there. And then it fell apart and there wasn't. And now it's kind of the opposite because nobody wants to put money into these. And so there's actually a huge gap. I mean, there's people are screaming for wanting more data centers. So it's really upside down now.
So, Alex, explain to the listeners out there what a data center, what the value of it is. Exactly?
All right. Well, let's see. Data center is basically a big building where the internet lives. they're buildings that have a certain amount of power supply. They're usually redundant, if not, triple redundant. And
there's
power
a lot
supply.
Of tubes going into the building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've got power coming from different sources. Even if all that fails, they usually have a generator on the top to keep anything plugged in working.
Right.
They have rooms that are air conditioned to keep all the servers. I mean, you're talking hundreds, if not thousands of servers in a space. A lot of heat, so you got to keep that air conditioned or they start having problems with heat.
So this is where all of our web pages live.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, basically.
So when you put stuff on a web page, it goes to these data centers.
Yeah. Google's stuff is all held in data centers.
Google's
Facebook,
strange and different.
Facebook has actually been one of the big buyers of space in Silicon Valley lately, or leasers, or people getting actually using the space.
Speaking of Facebook, quick mention, Al?
Yeah. Oddly enough, now that you mention Facebook, Facebook has become the most visited site. The most visited site.
The most visited site.
Of the top, Google has a listing of the top 1,000 sites, and Facebook is at number one. Funny because Google's not on that list, and I always think, do they just not report on themselves? I don't think they report on themselves.
Right, because they got to be higher than that, right?
Well,
you'd think everybody goes to Google.
I pretty much go to Google before I go anywhere else.
Yeah, but
if I know the URL, find Facebook.
Oddly enough, everybody doesn't use Google.
That's true. But everybody uses Facebook.
Well, people search it out. A lot of people do use Google, but not everybody uses, uses it. But, I guess Facebook is number one at 540 million visitors. And Yahoo is number two, live.com is number three, Wikipedia is number four, MSN.com is number five, Microsoft.com is number six, Blogspot.com is number seven. the list goes on. There's a thousand of them, so I don't think we have enough time to. But I'll post the link, by the way. This is based on the DoubleClick Ad Planner.
Okay, so the only thing about Blogspot being that isn't domain based because a lot of those blogs are actually private domains. So are they counting the traffic to the? It must be counting the traffic to their servers.
This is done by DoubleClick Ad Planner, so it probably has something to do with ads.
Huh. Yeah, although even for Blogspot, I'd say probably the majority is people who just have their username dot, Blogspot.
Yeah. Alex, thanks for the story on data centers. If you're building out a data center right now and you want a geek visit, and we'll mention you on air and kind of talk about it, I'd love to go see one of these new facilities. It's always fun to go to a data center. If you've got a chance to do it, it's kind of a neat experience to go into this room that's all this gear, and it's kind of a hub. When you see a network map of the internet, if you will, and these little hot spots, that's the data centers, right? Especially the big ones.
Mm-hmm. Especially when it's a hot, muggy day, that's a good day to visit a data center.
That's right. They're really
very nice,
cold.
Cool.
They're really
make sure you bring a sweater.
Yeah. Actually, the level of the temperature is actually increased in data centers because after a whole bunch of analysis of hard drive failures by Google a year ago or so, they found out they could actually run data centers hotter. So I think they're still running them hotter. Mm. Because, of course, the cooler you run it, the more expensive it is. GeekSpeak web servers on a blade in San Francisco, hosted by GNI.com. If you listen to the GeekSpeak podcast, you hear that mentioned every week. We don't normally mention on air, but I thought since we were talking about it. Okay. What? A virus seriously infected a person? What's going on,
yeah.
Lindsay?
Okay, so a British scientist, Dr. Marc Gasson, was the first human infected with a computer virus. So,
Is he fully human?
He may be part cybernetic.
Okay. This makes more sense.
Basically, he put a virus on an RFID chip and implanted the chip into his hand. And the thing that he's trying to determine is
like
whether
in the
or not,
skin, under the skin.
Yep.
Okay, creepy.
Exactly. I heard something a while back about somebody doing that with an unlock key to unlock their door. So I don't, this is the first virus, but I think other people have done implants.
Oh, there's been a lot of implants. Yeah. There's actually some digital tattoo kind of implants as well.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. So what he's trying to do is see if the virus can be passed to other electronics outside of his body.
So an RFID is a radio frequency identifier. It's the chip that kind of identifies things normally used in warehouse stuff. You can track packages. An RFID chip is, if you've got a card that lets you into doors that you just scan in front of it, that's an RFID chip. So I didn't know you could put a virus on one, and how does it infect? Do you know the details of that?
No, I looked around and I couldn't find all the details, but I'm guessing, just guessing that it's some sort of a pattern, a character pattern, but that something outside of you has to be able to read a character pattern.
I'm just surprised it could be active enough to actually cause an infection.
And there's different types. There is just purely passive, and then there's the active.
So it might be an active, you got a little battery in there.
Well, even with passive, if you walk by a device that scans you, if you find some vulnerability in the scanner, you can actually send it a signal that causes it to do something it shouldn't. It maybe compromise the system
that
it's running on.
And that would technically be a virus. So did he successfully do it?
He did. So he was successfully able to infect other machines in his
lab. So the story really should be, if he took an RFID that was already infected and put it into his skin and then infected a computer, the first computer infected by a human is the actual the story, right?
But don't invite this guy to your house, because what happens is he tries to find your computer and erase the hard drive.
Right.
And all he has to do is walk by.
Yeah. And he's got this horrible nasty sore on his hand.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, imagine this. Imagine you've got a bunch of different parts in your body that are electronic. Like, you're some CEO that has, a pacemaker, something like that.
Right.
Somebody wants to blackmail you,
Right.
They want to
put this in him and come over to you.
You're going to turn off your pacemaker with the virus.
That's nasty. We did actually cover a story a while ago about being able to affect, even pacemakers with RF, and the fear of that. Miles covered it. Like, if you did something in D.C. that did that, how many people would drop? It's kind of creepy.
And that's why this is kind of, I remember that, so it's kind of tied in.
Luckily, I think most of the time with pacemakers, if you lose it for a little while, the heart keeps going. Like, it's really a safety feature rather than a absolute.
Yeah, exactly.
But still, I wouldn't want it turned on. Thank you for the story. Kind of creepy. Mm-hmm. Lindsay, let's go ahead and, in a second, we'll have Alex. Alex, it's probably your turn. No, it's not. It's Al's turn. But let's, Alex, in a second, you're going to talk about new flexible LEDs. That means a flexible screen, which is kind of cool. But first, what's going on with Windows 7 and HP, Al?
So everybody is aware that HP has purchased Palm, which is a great thing to have happen. Palm has had some really good technology. HP is a technology company that has really deep pockets that, in my opinion, isn't really that great at coming out with new things. However, they are awesome at perfecting things that already exist. So for them to get Palm was a great thing. And the other thing that's interesting is, did you know that HP has smartphones? They've got like 4 or 5 smartphones out
there. Sure, I didn't know that, yes.
Well, but most people, what? HP has smartphones? Right. Yeah. Well, that's because they're not that great. but now...
Because they suck.
Yes. Right. And the thing about HP is they don't have an OS. They always have to license an OS from Microsoft. That's how they do their things. They have all these computers, and then they license the OS, and they pay...
In fact, I think I've got at work a couple Microsoft CE devices, and they're actually HP devices.
Right.
But they're running that.
Yeah, so it's a big deal for, you know, well, now, you know, HP buys Palm. You think, oh, they're going to, you know, build up their smartphone business. Yes, and also they just bought an OS. An operating system. So they've actually just, it's just been, it was rumored and widely expected that HP would come out with a tablet, but now they've announced that, there's a confirmation that HP is going to get rid of Windows on, especially this first Palm, this first tablet device, and they're going to use what is called WebOS, which is the system that Palm has built. So they're going to be severing that umbilical cord with Microsoft.
For their tablet,
which is just a matter of, you know, I mean...
It's interesting because Microsoft does have, I mean, their OS supports tablet.
Yes.
There are Microsoft tablets
but they
all
just
the place.
Were terrible. And but the thing about, like I said, about HP is they can take something and just make it an awesome product because they've got lots of really smart engineers who are just really good at just making things better. So I would say watch HP and watch what they do with this Palm. I mean, it was a great idea for them to purchase Palm, in my opinion. I think the guy who was behind it was actually the ex-CEO of Palm.
Oh, really?
Yeah, from years ago. But still, and so, but he knows that, you know, this kind of company, just a great, you know, good marriage, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
cool.
Interesting things coming forward from that.
Thank you. Okay, real quick, what's up with flexible screens?
All right, flexible screens. The Japanese have been working on cutting-edge technology again. They're working on OLED panels, which basically are very thin screens. They were focusing on flexibility, so they can have, you know, have it in gadgets, and they ended up getting to the point where you can have a functioning display screen that can actually be wrapped around a pen.
Whoa.
It's that flexible.
That's highly flexible.
It's also ends up being super thin. It's thinner than the strand of a human hair.
Whoa. And it works?
And it works.
And wow. It's OLED, which means it has light in it, too.
Yeah, and we will be, I'll get the links up. They've got pictures
of
all this.
Okay, so the reason
really cool.
Why the flexible screen like this is so cool is because you could theoretically hold a screen and actually unroll it, like pull it.
They're talking
out
about the possibility of this being real digital newspapers and paperwork and a lot of that sort of stuff. It's just one entry point,
that's
as well
awesome.
As all the electronics. It's super light. I mean,
right. Well, except for the battery pack. You got this piece of paper with a 4-pound
Well, they're OLEDs. They need a lot less power
that's
now.
True. Yeah,
so
cool.
The batteries can be smaller.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. Thanks, Alex. The Geekbit today, a great new app on the iPhone, celebrating, unfortunately, a sad loss. Al?
This is a weird thing. It's a Droid app.
Oh, it's a Droid app. Sorry about that.
A Droid iPhone app, and it's a tribute to Gary Coleman, who, of course, died this week. So you can get this thing, and it basically goes through a bunch of pictures. It's like a slideshow.
On the Droid, not the iPhone.
It's on the Droid,
on Android,
yeah.
Okay.
And it's free, and supposedly it's supposed to be kind of neat. You know, I mean, you can just kind of see it's a moving tribute. You know, it is ad-supported, but... still, you know,
that's nice.
Kind of amazing to see something, an app appear that quickly over this kind of thing. You know, Gary Coleman's a very big, well-known, popular star. So obviously building something for him would have been, you know, desirable. But, you know, you could see this happening for other people too,
you know. Or, you know, it could be kind of a morbid industry. You make a whole bunch of predefined apps celebrating somebody and then launch them when they pass away.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that's a...
I don't know.
It's a business plan.
It's right interesting. There. It's a geek bit.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
So.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, that was Al Luckow. And we also have Alex Leas and Lindsay Lonnie. And we are taking calls with questions and comments about technology, keeping in mind that we have a lot more news to cover. So it's your choice. 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I kind of want to do that selling voice. That's 1-800-6... Nah, I'm not really good at that. All right, well, we'll keep going. We have a lot more news stories, but we already have someone waiting from Carmel, so let's go ahead and say hello to a dial tone. Hello, Will in Carmel. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, hi. I need a little troubleshooting. I just installed a piece of equipment I bought a year ago and, of course, didn't put together until last night, and it works beautifully. It's something that allows me to, transmit my sounds from my computer throughout the house.
Okay.
And it works for absolutely every internet radio station except yours. And I don't know why that is. I mean, I do Pandora, I do KQED, KXJZ, the Swiss radio station,
the software
on
actually,
and on.
The software that you're running that actually connects to the feed, what is it?
The software that I'm running.
Meaning that you have a piece of hardware that transmits your signal to your speakers, correct? Or is there an individual separate box that sits there?
Oh, it's a separate box made by Creative called XMod Wireless. And what I can't figure out is...
How do you get the list? Is there a list on that site that shows you a whole bunch of different...
Just streaming from my Firefox.
Okay, so when you're at Firefox and you go to kosp.org and you click on the live, do you see a link there? And can you play that?
Yes, I normally play it all the time. I listen to you regularly. Since installing this, I can listen to everything, but not your station. I can listen to other stations through Windows Media Player, but not yours. I tried. There's an alternative for me to use iTunes. That doesn't work
How long has this been a problem?
Well, I only installed this piece of equipment last night.
I wonder
and
if our feed
I can
is down.
Get your station. When I disconnect it, I get your station. The error
comes up.
It says network error, and it says possibly I am not connected to the internet, but I am because I have two computers here just to check things out. And the parallel computer is receiving your station perfectly through the router. Mm-hmm. It also asks me if my proxy settings are correct. That's an area I don't understand.
Yeah. I think I know what's going on, but I'm actually testing right now. What we send out over the line is... A playlist file. That's actually what we link to. And that playlist file then links to our actual feed. And the playlist file is a little text file, actually. It's .m3u. And inside that file, and that actually probably downloads to your desktop or something, and then you have to open that. And some players don't do a good job of playing that in the feed. So you need to actually have a player to play it. Winamp is a good free one. The other thing you can do is actually open up that document in text editor. I know this is really quite complicated. If you want to send an email in, I'll give you the link directly to our URL. On my machine, when I click on this M3U file, it actually opens inside of iTunes and then plays from there. You'll probably hear a feed. Here I am right now. This is the live feed from KOSP. How far behind are we?
That's what I tried. Uh-huh. It comes into my iTunes. I've never used iTunes for that before, but this morning I did that on the show that comes up before yours does. And again, in iTunes, it gets added to the bottom of my music list, but when I play it, nothing.
You got me. It seems very, very strange.
It is strange.
The
feed
is definitely working.
ASUP so far is the only station that I can't, the only station I can't receive.
That's so weird.
Do you know if the other stations are also doing the M3U? Or are they
some other stations are. The thing is, once you get into iTunes, it's not the M3U file that's playing, right?
Yeah.
It's the other file. I think this is working. Get into iTunes, it's not the M3U file that's playing, right?
Yeah.
It's the other file. Yeah, it does work. That's interesting. So we're a little delayed on the feed, but it's functioning, of course.
Yeah.
I'm a little lost on why this isn't working for you. It seems like it could be an individual machine problem, but that seems strange to me, too.
Well, it works on his machine. It doesn't work on the device.
But the device is just an audio transfer. There's nothing else going on. It's not like a piece of hardware.
There's something about iTunes that does have motion remote speakers.
No.
Is that true? Can you play other things through iTunes?
Beg your pardon?
Can you play other things through iTunes to this?
Yes,
player?
Without any problem.
So
I mean,
play a song
music
and it works fine.
I play recorded music.
This doesn't make it.
It's not streaming.
You know,
on my
the
hard
proxy
drive.
Thing.
But this is the first time I actually try to connect a stream through iTunes.
See, here's the thing. Let me describe what's going on. This piece of hardware, to my knowledge, is just a receiver of audio, right? So if your machine can play audio and it's sending it, that shouldn't be changing. There's no reason for that to be changing. And that's the thing that's so strange. iTunes playing audio is iTunes playing audio. It's not. There's not differentness between each file. It's a very... You've completely lost me. I can suggest downloading Winamp and trying to play it through that, because there is free version of that on any OS. But other than that, I'm lost. Anybody else have ideas on this? We'd love to hear them. You can contact us at geekspeak.org.
If you just tell them, I'm trying to, get this wirelessly transmitted using something called an XMOD. By Creative.
All right. Well, thank you.
XMOD Wireless.
Thank you for the call. I'm sorry that we
haven't. Thank you.
Send us an email, too. I'd love to follow up with this. Okay?
I would appreciate it. Who do I address it to?
My email address is lyle@geekspeak.org. Okay?
Thank you very much.
You betcha. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we have another call from Santa Cruz. Let's go ahead and try to finish with one that we can answer. That'd be nice. Not that we're finishing. We're still taking calls the whole show. Kirkland in Santa Cruz, welcome to Geekspeak.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hey, I had this. Before I get into my thing, I had the same thing happen with my iTunes and KUSC.
Uh-huh.
And I deleted it from my playlist, from my main music library.
Yeah.
And then just went back to my radio stations, like where it shows them all in iTunes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I re-downloaded that link, sort of I re-put it into iTunes. And now it works fine.
So you deleted and re-put it in.
It could be that the older file is actually pointing to the wrong place, but it keeps on downloading it anyway. Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. So go into iTunes, delete the KUSP line, and then go and add it again. I like it. Yeah, thank you. Okay, what's your question?
Well, my problem is I've got two things. One is that the primary problem is I've got an iMac from around 2004, the 20-inch screen one, and I was told the inverter board went out. I replaced that. My screen is black. You can't, even if you shine light, you can't see anything on the desktop.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to be able to resurrect it because there's still stuff I got in there that I'd like.
Is this one of the lamps or one of the candy things?
One of the what?
What kind is it? It's a 20-inch?
This is one of the ones with the dome,
it's a
20-inch,
right? 20-inch, right. It's like 1.7.
Does it look like a lamp? Does it have like a little white ball and then a kid?
Oh, not the snowball. No.
Okay,
no,
so
no.
it's the bigger one. So resurrecting this, it's probably, it's a motherboard or video screen driver problem or video screen, video card, if you will. Like something in there is failing. It sounds like a hardware issue. Resurrecting is probably not going to be worth it, but I see the temptation. It's a 20-inch screen. I would say probably not. I mean, it could be a hard drive, right? So if it's a hard drive, then resurrecting is okay. Opening those things is not fun, is the problem.
I've opened it up to put the inverter board in, which is not any big deal, but
it didn't work after that.
That was the easiest fix.
Right.
Yeah.
And it didn't work.
Beyond that,
can you launch it in target mode and actually have it show up as a FireWire drive? Have you tried that?
Oh, I can still boot the hard drive and have it mount on my other computer.
Okay.
With a FireWire. But the thing is that I tried to pull my iPhoto off, and it doesn't pull it off the same way as it's listed on the original machine. But I got all the individual photographs. The real problem is my address book. That's the only thing that I wanted to get off intact.
And
I can't see any way to do that.
Okay, so the address data is stored in the user library folder under app support under address book, or maybe Apple address book.
Okay, app support, address book.
And there actually are files there that the only issue is that to load them, you kind of need to replace that stuff on the new machine. So you're going to have to do kind of a remove that folder from your new machine and put it somewhere safe, put the one from your old machine onto the same location, launch the address book, then do an export from there, then shut down, move that stuff out, move the new stuff back in, launch again, and then import. So it's kind of a whole complicated process. Alex?
The actual...
Okay, so I've got to actually take that file out of my new machine so that actually the old one has a place to go.
That's right. That's the way to do it.
Your address book information?
Because it has the same name, they can't exist in the same place. It's going to automatically load in the same place?
Yeah, basically. Alex?
Your address book information is stored underneath your main user account. There's a library folder, and underneath that there's one called application support, and underneath that there's one called address book. Copy that whole folder to back up your current one, and then replace that folder with the same path that's on your old machine, and that should get all your old address book stuff in place.
Okay.
So don't have address book running when you do that. Yeah.
Here's the thing is, because I didn't want to start putting a whole bunch of addresses in my new one, I haven't even run my new address book. So
oh, great.
Yeah, then just replace it.
Okay, right?
Yeah, yeah, just replace it, and when you power it up, it should see that those files.
Yeah, just make sure address book is closed when you're doing the copy of the folder, so that way when it quits, it doesn't try and rewrite it again.
Right.
Okay.
So don't have address book running when you play with that address book folder in the application support. Thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks.
Wow, we were able to help somebody.
Hey, we win. iPod, iPad.
Yeah. Interesting. The folks over in China have been hard at work trying to bootleg the iPad. And I have some links up today showing the actual thing, which is pretty silly. It looks exactly like the iPad. And it has all the same exact icons and everything. They're selling it over there. It's, you know, obviously completely illegal.
Is it running the OS or is it running?
I believe it's running... Linux, some version of Linux that they threw on there so that they could get it going and try to convince people that it was an iPad. But, it's just like anything.
Be careful, I guess.
You know, when you look at something, you know, coming out of China, it's an interesting thing to look at. They call it the iPad, but all over the place they keep changing it back to iPad in the manual. It comes in the same exact box. You know, they made a box that looks exactly like Apple's box.
It's great.
Well, even the icons.
At one point, it's called the iPad. They changed that all around, but they say it's probably about $100, you know, over there. But, you know, I mean, beware of this stuff.
All right.
You think, oh, this is not right, you know.
Thanks for that update. Lindsay, what's going on with coral reefs?
So, there was a nonprofit study in 1998 by the World Resources Institute. They worked with the UN and several other organizations, you know, nonprofits, trying to figure out how human activity is putting about 60% of coral reefs at risk in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, it didn't really reach a large audience as they had hoped. But now they're using technology in order to redo the study. So in 2008, they restarted it using Google Earth. And they're working with another nonprofit called Reef Check that basically trains volunteer divers to go out and take detailed measurements all over the world.
Cool, of different sizes of species and things of that nature.
Exactly.
To get an idea of the health.
Right.
And so, then this shows up. Okay, go on, sorry.
The map is really neat.
Yeah.
You can go to the website, I'll post it up, and it shows the whole Earth with all the coral reefs in different colors. And they're going to finish it in September and release all the results. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So if you're a diver, look it up and do some research on the fly. It's always fun when you're diving to do a little bit of measuring and such. Cool, thanks.
Sure.
And that's all. And that's associated with Google Earth.
Yes. Exactly. That's what they're using.
So that's helping saving this planet. But, you know, what about our other close celestial body, Alex?
Well, for as far as people being able to help out and contribute like these divers are, you can also help analyze data from the moon. It seems that the NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, the LRO, has been accumulating tons of data about the moon. I mean, just information, pictures, everything. Just so much data that they can't keep up. So an Oxford scientist named Chris Lintott, he's put together a website and has been trying to get people to come and help analyze this data. Just anybody who wants to help, amateur astronomers.
Cool.
Astronomers. And so you got moonzoo.org, spelled like you would think it would be. And... so yeah, he's. You can just go through. They have a whole training thing, so they teach you how what it is you need to do, and they just start giving you data, and you can process through, and you can contribute to understanding our moon.
That's very cool. Thank you. Well, while we're on celestial bodies, Al, what's the sad news in the solar system? I mean, I know that Gary Coleman passed away yesterday.
Yeah, but this is bad too. Turns out Jupiter lost a stripe.
Oh,
yeah.
Just when I was getting used to it.
Demoted.
One of its big prominent stripes was in the southern half, and it just disappeared. And, you know, Jupiter is the planet that has all these different colored stripes on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gone. And
we need to have a dirge.
I really don't. We should maybe come up with an Android app talking about the sadness.
Just slowly a color fading away.
But actually, a lot of these bands are actually high altitude clouds, sort of, on the, you know, Jupiter. So having something disappear.
It's really weather patterns we're looking at.
Yeah,
right?
they're seeing a lot of different changes in Jupiter lately. Mm-hmm. Of course, their cloud is like, it's a cloud that's like bigger than the Earth. But,
right.
You know,
I mean, of course.
I mean, when I say cloud, but so it's a big deal. But they've just noticed a lot of changes on there. Most notably, the loss of this one big long stripe.
All right. Well, thanks for that update. Yeah.
The big red spot's still there, right?
Yes.
The storm's still there. Okay. It's kind of amazing, isn't it?
Because that would freak me out.
That'd be a bummer. If that
you can still quickly make an icon of Jupiter. It's okay.
I have to update all my sketches of Jupiter now.
All right. From Pleasure Point, Michael, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Am I there?
Yes, you are here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, I have a question about wireless and servers in my MacBook.
Okay.
When I take my MacBook and I go to like a local coffee shop, for example, and if I type in a website name that I've never been to before and I hit return, it automatically, and I'm running Safari or Firefox, actually, for that matter, and I hit return, it puts in the www.com, and it goes to the website.
Okay.
If I'm at home and I do exactly the same thing, it does not add that www nor the .com. What's going on?
That has to do with the DNS.
Okay.
So the way your machine looks up a URL in the line is to connect to the domain name server, the local domain name server,
right,
that's provided by your ISP, and then get an IP address. And what some ISPs do to make it better for you or healthy or whatever is if a domain name doesn't get hit, it doesn't succeed correctly, they'll send back a, let's try it with a .com, let's try it with a .dub.
Oh.
So the ISP is actually can control that if your browser is not sending that data. I'm surprised that your browser is sending a just machine name. No, machine name would work, because if you're in like in a local area network environment, you could actually have a machine named Google, right? And then if you typed in Google, it would successfully go to that server, if you will.
Right.
Any URL can potentially work. It's the domain name server that tells if it's not or not. Alex, what do you think?
I find that so annoying that ISPs do that. I could completely agree. That's what's going on.
The search engine one's the most annoying to me.
Leave it to the browser. The browser already knows how to figure this stuff out. People can choose. Now they completely remove the choice from people.
So another thing that can happen, and this happens to people all the time, is if you put a domain name that doesn't actually exist, no one's registered it, and your domain name server, you know, can't succeed, instead of returning a, sorry, we don't know what's going on, which is like what the browser would want to tell you, they send it to a search site.
Yeah.
And the search site then returns. And that search is totally based on the ISP relationship with some. So it's not necessarily Google or anything you want. It's whatever the ISP, and they get a little bit of money.
It's worse than that. Like, I've noticed lately, I was just working with a website. We just registered a new domain for my mom and got their little website up and running. And you just type just the name by itself, and it ends up redirecting you to somebody else's website that's actually a slightly different URL, because they're looking it up, and that is the first one on Google Hits. And so now you're sending traffic to a different website.
Right, that's horrible. Well, thank you very much. That's what's going on.
Wait, sorry, just one last question.
Uh-huh.
So this was the SBC. So is the action here to call SBC?
Yeah, have fun time.
Nothing's going to happen, though.
Is SBC at home or at the coffee shop?
SBC is at home.
Right, so what they're doing is they're not cheating for you. Your ISP is not going, oh, let me go ahead and do this instead for you. The other one is, I personally would just switch and start when you don't know exactly the site that you want to go into, go ahead and search for it instead and choose the web server, the search engine that you want to use.
It's like when I go to KUSP and I don't type in the word, let's say it was KUSP.org, I type in KUSP return.
Yeah.
I expect to see a .com, right? But I don't. I mean,
not necessarily. I mean, here's,
it sits there.
Here's the thing is, that's not actually what you should be typing in the URL. KUSP is not the same thing as KUSP.org or .com. It's a completely different name, right? That universal reference link really has to be clear. So go ahead and start putting in the .com or the .org, depending on what you want to do, and then you won't have this problem.
No, I know I don't have a problem. I was just trying to solve it so I didn't have to.
So you don't have to. Well, are you on a Mac or a PC?
I'm on a Mac, but I don't want a PC.
Okay, you can do this. If you want to set up a quick list that will actually go directly to the site you want with really short things, you can name anything you want and have it direct to any URL you want. And the thing you want to look up is the hosts file, and you can edit it if you put in your password. normally we don't do this, but inside you can actually set up your own user host file and cause any URL to go to any other URL without asking anybody. And so it's a kind of a fun thing to do. If you want to send an email, I'll do a little write-up on it. It's Great. I do it all the time for web development, but
Great.
It's hacking. Okay, cool.
Thanks, guys. Hey, I only listen to the podcast, and I always enjoy it.
All right, great. Thanks.
I know.
He's always listening to the podcast.
Well, he's not
so
listening
to
the podcast
to
now.
In the future or the past. That was kind of creepy. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, we could get him back on the line and get the lottery numbers.
Yeah, that would be a good idea.
I'm into that.
Because I haven't actually released the podcast yet.
Yeah.
Two more calls or more news? It's so tough. Well, it is Big Sur, so we'll go to Big Sur. Jim, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Hi.
I process photographic files on an iMac and a MacBook Pro. Usually somewhere around 120 megabytes or so. And I want to do larger files up to 3 gigabytes. And I'm tired of the spinning beach ball and the delays that Mac takes to get ready to do something. So I'm thinking about, here's what I'm calling about. I want a recommendation on a Mac product that will process, has the speed and memory to process up to 3 gigabyte size files, and the name of a PC that can do that, because I'm thinking about going back to PC.
Well, what is this file that you're
dealing
with?
It's a 3 gigabyte picture?
Well, if I take do an 8x10 film and do a panoramic with three of those, I can get up there pretty high.
You know, there's a great new project at UCS, one of those big screens in the engineering building, that you actually can do that kind of resolution on a screen, multiple screens. Very cool. So what are you outputting with? I mean, when you finally deal with these files, are you doing for screen or are you doing for print?
It has to be for print.
First for the web, but then for print.
Yeah, so you're just dealing with massive files.
Big print.
3 gig file, you're going to be able to do it no problem with a MacBook Pro tower, that you will, no problem. I would assume that the new iMacs can handle that. 3 gig file, I mean, it's big. Yeah,
you need to have at least 4 gigs of RAM.
Okay, when I bought the iMac, I did not realize that it's not much more than a MacBook Pro with a big screen.
Yeah.
It has limitations.
Better processor, larger hard drive, it's a better hard drive.
Mm-hmm. It's not a Mac Pro.
No, you know what? The other thing is the iMacs, the new iMacs, depending on which version you've got, have a really good video card too. And that's one of the things you need to deal with this. But the other thing is the software you're using to launch this. If you're using the software that's actually going to take advantage of the video card, you're going to be able to deal with this file pretty well, like Photoshop, the newest version of Photoshop.
Photoshop and Lightroom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And plugins.
I haven't tried getting a file this size, but you're going to want a lot of RAM on this machine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you're going to want to run nothing else, and it's still going to be a little slow. On the Windows side, like what part number you need, which, Dell machine or whatever, I'm not going to be able to answer that off the bat. You'd have to look up what, the parameters to figure out
biggest
if it's going to run. You have to test this.
You're going to need a lot of memory. That's the biggest thing. I've noticed,
and
even when I work
with
Photoshop and just a few
dedicated
images.
Dedicated graphic memory.
Yeah.
There are programs, though, that take a graphic photographs, and they essentially build a proxy out of them, so you're able to manipulate the whole thing.
Which Lightroom's going to do.
Yeah.
Lightroom does that.
Yeah. So, but that basically, you're talking of processor speed. It's not necessarily a software fix you're going to find. You're going to need you're going to need a big, bad machine,
Right.
And a Windows machine.
If you have a recommendation on the name of that machine.
If I had to do this a lot and really wanted, I would get a Mac Tower, Mac Pro.
Those are the ones that I use. That's usually the only kind of machine that I buy. I have a.
But you could easily do this in a Windows environment too. You'd want to go with Windows 7, for the memory management, and you'd want to get a lot of RAM. And the video card is going to be really important. If you can get a video card with enough RAM on it, it's going to really help you as well.
Okay.
But
great.
Yeah, it's cool. It's really cool that you're doing that. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
I want that machine.
Last week, Maker Faire happened, and Ben actually went. I think he got some audio for us. When he gets back to the show, we'll talk about Maker Faire. But it sounds like Timothy went. And Timothy, how was Maker Faire?
No, I didn't go.
I was wondering
if anyone went and what the report back was.
It was awesome. I loved it. Wait, I'm in bed with a broken back. That's right. No, I didn't go. Nobody here?
Nope.
I wish.
Keep in touch. Like, just hold on for another week, and Ben will be back, and we'll talk a lot about Maker Faire. Maker Faire is a wonderful fair, you know, county fair kind of thing that's all about making things, hacking things, creating your life, owning your world. And if you want to know more about, like, the maker movement, getting Make Magazine or Craft Magazine, both by O'Reilly Publishing, I think. Yeah. Really wonderful. In fact, I was going to interview the editor and the guy that organized it, and he's got a new book, and that will be soon, too. So we'll be talking more about Maker Faire in the next couple of weeks of Geek Speak. So,
okay, great.
Okay. Thanks. All right, let's go ahead and take one more news item. We just did Jupiter, so that means that Lindsay's up. Your choice. You got three things. Go for it. Which one do you want to do?
All right, I'll just start at the top here.
All right.
Bacteria living in clouds may control rain and snow patterns.
Well, what now?
What?
I didn't know
so
that.
So apparently there's these bacteria that feed on rotting agricultural crops.
Okay.
And they get caught up in the precipitation and end up in clouds. And they have the ability to make water freeze at lower temperatures.
Interesting.
So now they're doing a bunch of studies on this, and they're wondering that if there's areas where there have been crops that have died or been over-farmed areas, they're thinking that this might be part of the cause of why there's less rain and precipitation in those areas. And they're also wondering if they can plant certain crops in areas and bring more rain to those areas, if the crops are the kind of crops that these bacteria feed on.
Wow. I mean, it's amazing. I didn't think of it. So, I mean, we of course know that impurities in water cause water to react differently. Like, you know, salt causes water to not, to not be solid for a longer period of time. So this thing actually makes it freeze sooner, which is really cool.
Ski lodges are already using it to create.
Really?
Are they? Yeah.
So let me just ask one thing here. We're talking about taking massive amounts of bacteria and injecting this into our air, right?
What could possibly go wrong? All right, this in a moment, the USB of the week. This is Geek Speak. It's a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence. That's the name it is, registered service mark. And we thank the Puppet Master for its use. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio KOSP. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. The stream is sometimes, I guess. We'll figure that out. My name's Lyle Troxell, Lindsay Lonnie, and Alex Lees. We're also here. And, of course, Rick Philman was answering the phones for us. And here's Al Luckow.
Hi, everyone. This is Al with Geek Speak's Crazy USB Device of the Week. Usually during this segment, I talk about real USB devices that are just plain ridiculous. Well, today, I found a site, dialogue05.com, that although the devices are not real, they are certainly entertaining. I also think it's just a matter of time before some overseas manufacturer starts making some of these things. For example, and they have pictures of this stuff. For example, they have a bra that hooks in the center with a USB connector. They've got a watch band with a USB clip that attaches to your wrist. A woven cable belt with three USB belt buckles, you know, if you can imagine that.
Cool.
His and her USB wedding rings with, of course, the male and female connectors so you can hook them together.
What?
A USB rotary phone dialer and a USB tie for connecting with clients. So it's got a little USB connector at the very bottom. So, hi, how you doing? I'm Bob, you know, and then you just plug in. So there's a lot of fun things to look at on this site. Again, they're not real. It's more of a USB art project, but it's definitely worth a look for a chuckle or two.
Thank you, Al. For KOSP and Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.